Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, pushing the Iran nuclear deal in the United States. An interesting relationship between Iran and the U.S. A look at the value of encryption in the cyber world.
Encryption allows you to take your data, your photos, your emails, all your electronic communication, and kind of lock it up.
And we hear about a rapper who finds himself in financial and legal trouble. It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. The Obama administration is continuing a media blitz to promote its landmark nuclear deal with Iran to an American public distrustful of Tehran. The lengthy, complicated, and highly technical pact unveiled in Vienna last week is proving to be a tough sell to nearly all Republican legislators and even some members of Obama's Democratic Party, who have 60 days to review and vote on the accord. VOA's Michael Bowman begins our coverage of the Iran nuclear deal.
Did Iran win too many concessions while giving up too little? Appearing on U.S. television, ABC's This Week program, Secretary of State John Kerry said no.
The United Nations resolution, which brought about the sanctions in the first place, said that if Iran will suspend its enrichment and come to negotiations, all the sanctions will be lifted. Now, they've done more than just come to negotiations. They've actually negotiated a deal.
Key lawmakers remain unconvinced and angry the United Nations could approve the deal before Congress has a chance to weigh in. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, had this to say after meeting with Vice President Joe Biden.
The president is going to go to the UN Security Council Tuesday before Congress has done its work. I mean, at just a base level, that's highly problematic. I'm very concerned that with all that's happened, what that's going to mean is that they're going to be agreeing to an agreement that they don't even know they can implement.
Not so, according to Kerry.
They have a right to have a vote. But we prevailed on them to delay the implementation of that vote out of respect for our Congress.
Even some Democrats most loyal to President Barack Obama, like Senator Ben Cardin, are not committing to a yes vote.
We have 2 months, and we're going to use that time to better understand this. And I respect the fact that this is not an easy decision for members to make, and I plan to take the time to understand it before I make my decision.
The president will need the backing of Cardin and others to prevent Congress from overriding his veto of a likely congressional vote disapproving the deal.
This deal will make America and the world safer and more secure. Still, you're going to hear a lot of overheated and often dishonest arguments about it in the weeks ahead.
Meanwhile, Iran's supreme leader and top cleric pledged to continue his country's assertive role across the Middle East, adding that should war come, the United States would suffer humiliation. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
There was a time when Iran and the U.S. cooperated in a number of areas, including education. Last month, the Institute for International Education led a group of academics from U.S. colleges to Iran to explore potential areas of renewed cooperation. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with the group's Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships, Daniel Obst, who explains the nature of cooperation between Iran and the U.S. before relations soured in the late 1970s.
Well, in past years, there has been some cooperation between academic institutions, but generally very limited, generally limited to individual faculty members discussing, but also to some student exchanges. There are about 10,000 Iranian students in the United States. But what was lacking really are the institutional frameworks that match research and exchange priorities on both sides. So really this effort of this delegation was to explore how to collaborate more on research, more on program development, and on student and faculty exchanges.
Well, one would imagine there's still suspicion in both countries, as there is around the world, about any kind of cooperative effort between the U.S. and Iran. Is that posing any problem or problems?
Well, what we found on the delegation was that there's enormous goodwill in Iran towards the United States, and especially in the education space. because I think what we found is that many of the academics and professors that we met on our trip were actually educated in the U.S., or their children are currently studying in the U.S., so there is a lot of familiarity with the higher education system in the U.S. and a lot of goodwill.
Now, until this agreement is agreed upon, and I'm talking about the one reached in Vienna over the past week or so, can you go forward? Has anything been done? Has any progress been made?
Well, we just came back from our delegation a few weeks ago. We plan to release a white paper later this month, and that white paper will actually lay out some recommendations for what types of educational activities to pursue, but also help U.S. educators and Iranian educators understand what is allowable under the different restrictions. So I think there was a lot of confusion around what you can or can't do, and there's a lot that can already happen.
So what would be the scenario you can envision if everything you see for the future comes true?
Well, what we've seen is that a lot of institutions on both sides were particularly interested in expanding cooperation on the research side. So, and especially looking at research areas of mutual interest, for example, nanotechnology, medical and health sciences, but especially water conservation and environmental management. And it was really interesting to see that almost every institution we went to expressed interest in exploring research cooperation around water shortage, because it's such a huge issue in Iran. But in the U.S., we face similar challenges because of the long-term water shortages affecting the Colorado River Basin. So you see there are a lot of different similarities in terms of the research interests, and I think a lot can happen when we cooperate.
Daniel Obst is the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships at the Institute for International Education in New York City. Daniel, once again, thanks for being with us. Always appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Professional astronomers, with help from amateur stargazers, have discovered a fascinating binary star system some 730 light years away from us in the Draco constellation. This two-star system contains a very hot and dense white dwarf that is actually devouring its larger companion star by stealing its gas. The scientists say that the white dwarf's mass is so dense that a teaspoon of material from it would weigh as much as an elephant. Another factor that sets this star system apart from others is that it contains a large amount of helium but no hydrogen, which is very strange since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. The University of Cambridge-led team made their findings by analyzing data gathered in 2014 by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, along with additional observations made by a collective of amateur and professional astronomers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what do you have to share?
Well, we're monitoring this breaking story out of Turkey. A suicide bomber attacked just across the border from Kobani, Syria. Of course, that's been in the news because of ISIS or ISIL. At least 28 confirmed dead at the present time. We're seeing on social media people posting video of the attack, photos from the attack, people already offering their condolences, and the term is trending, the name of the city and about the attack on in both worldwide and in the U.S., so a trending topic this morning. Another trending topic here in the U.S., U.S. and Cuba, after 50-plus years, the U.S. and Cuba.
Yes, this is a big story today here
in Washington. It is the very big story today, and the word is historic. Everyone calling this historic on social media, people posting pictures of the what is to become later today, the Cuban embassy here in the U.S. and the U.S. embassy in Havana. There's a video on voanews.com of the State Department adding the Cuban flag into the foyer where it has all of the nation's flags, all the different nations around the world, into its lobby. So moments like that are certainly trending on social media this morning. We see little bits like that that are going to be going viral, perhaps. And in fact, there's another viral video, changing gears a bit. Mick Fanning, he's a world champion surfer. There's a video of him. He was at a surfing competition in South Africa.
Oh, I saw that. That was horrible.
Yeah, he came face-to-face with a shark.
They think it was a great white.
Yeah, it looks like a great white from the video. And He said he punched the shark a couple of times, and he was able to get away unscathed, thankfully. But the memes are now popping up, as oftentimes they do in these kind of situations. People placing him in different situations, scenes from the movie Jaws, for example. One of the sharks from Katy Perry's Super Bowl performance back in February. So a lot of different memes, but it's thankfully a positive outcome for him, and one that we can all laugh about now and enjoy on social media.
They zoomed in right away to rescue him. That was pretty neat.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing video online. I'm sure everybody out there will see it today trending.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, safety steps in the cyber world, and a rapper finds himself in hot water on two fronts. For over a year now, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, has been on a campaign warning against the dangers of computer encryption. He's pushing congressional leaders and Silicon Valley executives to build in such secret safeguards as what are called backdoors and key escrows that would give agencies like the FBI emergency access to data critical for stopping crime and protecting national security. But now a group of cybersecurity researchers and cryptographers is pushing back, arguing such measures could make the entire Internet more vulnerable to hacking attacks. International Edition's Doug Bernard follows cyber issues and spoke with VOA's Pete Heinlein about the encryption debate.
Think of encryption as sort of like a lock. Encryption allows you to take your data, your photos, your emails, all your electronic communication, and kind of lock it up such that anybody who doesn't have that lock won't be able to get access to it. It'll just be electronic gibberish. So it's a great way to protect your information from prying eyes. Now, one of the reasons, the principal reasons, I think Director Comey is so concerned about encryption is because he says, look, as so much of our lives are kept on mobile devices now, that data very often can be useful in helping stop crime or even, you know, protect the national security. But with encryption, without those keys to get inside it, the mobile phones and computers, as he calls, as he says it, become safes that you can never unlock.
What's a backdoor?
So if we're thinking of encryption as something like a lock, think about your data as being kept in perhaps a house. Your house has front door, back door, maybe windows, whatnot. These are all ways that bad guys potentially can break into your house and steal your stuff. So in an electronic form, these are basically pathways that bad guys can use to get in and steal your data and, you know, muck about with your things. So much as your front door is the main point of access, a back door is actually a secret path that a software engineer builds into a program, and perhaps only they and perhaps maybe the government only knows, ideally, about that back door. A key escrow, think of it as like giving a key to a neighbor. That neighbor becomes, they end up holding a bunch of keys to all their neighbor's house so that if something happens and somebody needs to get in, they're a trusted person, they can take that key that you've given them and get into it.
Okay, so we hear what Director Comey is saying. What are the cryptographers saying?
When you think about, you know, protecting your house and locks and doors and that sort of thing, it does really kind of make good sense. But what cryptographers are saying is, look, you know, encryption and cryptography are really much more complicated than these metaphors and analogies that we use. So what they're saying is that any point of access into a system creates a vulnerability. So the least vulnerable house in the world is one that has no doors, no windows, and no way to get in or out. But that's not very useful. So they like to keep entry points as few as possible. By building in back doors, perhaps, or key escrows where the encryption keys are held, what they're saying is fundamentally you are building insecurity not only into that encrypted system, but really into the internet as a whole. And so if you push for these things, you're just going to make the internet less secure, increase the number of hacking attacks, and put more of your private data at risk.
Well, I'm just one little guy. Why should I care?
It's one thing to think, you know, I don't really have anything to hide. You hear that a lot. You know, I'm just me. You know, I don't really worry about it. I think almost universally is that people may say that up until the point that their data is hacked. People may say, I feel secure in my house. I don't really worry about crime, up until the point that somebody breaks in and steals things. And then so often you hear those individuals saying, I feel fundamentally violated. I don't feel safe anymore. And I think the same is true electronically. You may feel safe and comfortable online, but up until that moment that someone steals your identity or steals your data or starts putting out false things about you on the internet, then you start feeling very vulnerable and you really understand the value, I think, of encryption.
Thanks, Doug and Pete. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Rapper 50 Cent has declared bankruptcy after a court ruled he had to pay $5 million to a New York woman for releasing a sex tape without her permission. International Edition's David Byrd and Ray McDonald talked about the multimillionaire's case, which will go ahead despite his insolvency.
When your album is Get Rich or Die Trying, and you actually do get rich and don't die, to declare bankruptcy might seem a little strange. Ray, what is this with 50 Cent saying he's bankrupt or filing for Chapter 11 protection?
It was all a strategic maneuver, Dave. On July 13th, 50 Cent filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy just a few days after losing a lawsuit. He was ordered to pay a $5 million compensatory judgment after a woman sued him over a sex tape he posted featuring her a few years back.
Now, this woman is rapper Rick Ross's ex-girlfriend.
That's exactly right, and 50 is beefing with Rick Ross. So.
And so this is kind of like, okay, I'm going to shame you in public.
And jab you.
Okay, but the court ruled in the woman's favor that she was actually defamed or libeled, or not libeled, I guess that's print, but she was defamed by this videotape.
This is correct. Now, back in May, Forbes magazine estimated 50 Cent's net worth to be $155 million. I think it's important to note that the man is not out of money. In fact, he's making light of this entire situation. He posted an online photo of himself standing next to a tiny little smart car, saying, yeah, things are tough out here.
My money on my mind, got a meal out the deal, and I'm still in the grind. That shorty says she filling my stash, she filling my flow. A girl from what did they buy, and they ready to go. I'm here, bottle full of blood, mama, I got what you need. You need to fill it up.
Well, now, he wears Armani suits and Jimmy Choo shoes. He has, like, a Rolex on his arm.
He's doing promotion for his latest movie, Southpaw.
Right, and he also sold his vitamin water interest for $100 million. Now, he did have to pay out another judgment when somebody sued his headphone manufacturing company for copyright infringement or trademark infringement or something?
This is correct. And 50 makes the point that when you are successful, he says, I have a bullseye on my back. I'm an easy target. But this lawsuit has not played itself out yet. The $5 million judgment, as I said, is for compensatory damages. Punitive damages are still to be determined.
So he could be forced to pay this. I thought when you go into Chapter 11, that protects you from your creditors, so all these judgments against you and anybody you owe money to just disappear.
In a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, proof of insolvency is not required to file. It's more a reorganization of whatever assets you do have. How much does 50 have? At this point, we don't know, but we may find out.
All right. Now, if you want to send Ray a tweet, He is Ray on the Hits at Twitter.com. You can also hit him up on at VOA underscore music. And, of course, you can send us a tweet here at International Edition. We are at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to hit me up, I'm at David underscore DBird. And that's B-Y-R-D on Twitter.
Patrons of a bar in the U.S. state of New Jersey this weekend had a night to remember when singer-songwriter Bruce Springsteen gave a surprise show that lasted for nearly 2 hours. He performed 15 songs, mixing in favorites that spanned his career. Springsteen has long been known for his drop-in performances at various hotspots, but the 65-year-old rocker hasn't done as many surprise appearances in recent years, making the event Saturday night even more special for his fans. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.